Welcome to the Alcohol Free Life podcast, brought to you by thesoberclub.com. I'm Genuinely Grace. This is for you if you've quit the booze or you'd like to, or maybe you're just sober curious. I'll bring you tips and motivation without any judgment, and there'll be inspiration from experts, quitlet authors, and sober heroes. Hi, and welcome to the podcast. How are you doing on this week that we have been released, some of us in the UK, released into the wild and into pub gardens? I wrote a blog post at the beginning of the week, actually, just kind of acknowledging that not everyone feels completely okay about all of this, because I think there's just so much fear and trepidation being around, so much collective fear. And I think certainly for people who ditch the booze during lockdown, this can feel really tricky, that suddenly there's all this sort of excitement, allegedly, of meeting people and drinking again. And, you know, there's been all this talk about, oh, wow, we'll have to get hideously drunk because we're now allowed to. All of that nonsense. But, you know, I just wanted to acknowledge that it is entirely normal if you're actually feeling a little bit wobbly about getting out into social situations. It's really quite normal. I mean, not only that, most of us don't even know how to get dressed anymore. how do you get dressed to go out when all you've done for a year is kind of put a top on and, you know, mix it with your PJ bottoms? it's a real thing. So don't feel you're unusual if you're suffering a little bit of anxiety over some of this. Having said that, I did manage to go out for a meal in one of those kind of inside outside jobs, you know, a kind of tent kind of thing. It was absolutely freezing. So absolutely freezing, like mid-February. What is going on? But yeah, it was very nice to be able to go out for a meal. I haven't done that for such a long time, so it did feel good. But, you know, just back to what I was saying, if for you this feels, if you do feel anxious about getting out, particularly if you ditch the booze and now this is new for you, having to sort of meet up with friends, then you know what I'm going to say. Do your prep. Absolutely do your prep. Think ahead. Decide, you know, where you're going, obviously, and make sure that the venue you're going to has got alcohol-free drinks. And if they haven't, take your own. Give your friends a heads up as to, you know, what's going on. Choose whatever you want to say to them. It doesn't have to be the truth, but it can be. It's quite hard to fight against, you know, a simple statement like, I feel better when I don't drink. Who's going to argue with that? You know, make sure you plan to leave early, because you probably will have a lower boredom threshold, almost certainly. When people start to get drunk and repeat themselves, it's so boring. I don't know who it was said that sober poor people are boring. It's literally the opposite. And plan something nice for yourself the next morning, nice and early, even if it's just a walk. So, you know, do a little bit of prep and just make sure you get connected. You know, chat. We have so many discussions about this kind of stuff on the Sober Club, because people will say, you know, they know they've got this massive trigger coming up, and they just really want to talk it through. And one woman was going off in a camper van. So lucky. I'm so jealous. Going off in a camper van, and the association is always that's where they drink. You know, they sort of stop places, and the association is with a fridge full of booze. So she had to kind of get her head around, a new way. And we all kind of talked her down. And now she's got a fridge full of great alcohol-free drinks and a copy of my book. And she took a picture of my book next to a kind of glass of alcohol-free something or other. And I don't know, first time I've actually been jealous of my own book getting to travel, right? Actually, no, I did get jealous when it went to Australia too. So make sure you know, get connected, get some support. Don't try and do this on your own. If you've got this kind of wobbly feelings going around your head saying, I'm just not sure, or maybe, you know, well, maybe it's okay. You know, it's only been a little while and I'll just have one. If you've chosen to moderate, that's fine. But if you're doing this because, you know, you're just kind of falling into it, then definitely challenge yourself and make sure you get some connection. There was a nice piece in Marie Claire this week about this topic, about pubs opening up, but actually so many more people choosing to ditch the booze, or choosing at least to think about what their alcohol intake and think about what it's doing for them. And I contributed some you know, some comments for that piece. The questions, you know, again, that I always get people to ask themselves, if you're right at the beginning of this journey, is just ask yourself, you know, why do I want to ditch the booze? But then also ask yourself, why don't I want to give up? And that's really important. I'm not just being facetious there. What's stopping you? What are the reasons why you, actually a large part of you wants to carry on drinking? It's important to notice that, to recognise it. Perhaps it is social. Perhaps it's that you want to numb stuff out, but be honest with yourself, and then ask yourself, you know, what will change if you do? What's the best that could happen? You've listened to some podcasts, hopefully. You've hopefully read some Quitlet books. You've got a little bit of inspiration. What could happen if you stop? And that's a bit where you can get super excited and write down some dreams, if you like. And then what will happen if you don't stop? What will change if you don't stop? And take yourself down that path. So they're really simple questions, but they're worth asking yourself. My guest, I'm so thrilled that I got to speak to Dr. Adi Jaffe. I heard of his work ages ago. I'll mention that in the interview. He's very well respected. His work and research focus on changing the way people think about and deal with mental health issues. And he's absolutely passionate about the role of shame. This was something I really wanted to talk to him about. Shame in destroying lives and these stigmas around mental health. He's very inspirational, very motivational. Absolutely love his work. Enjoy the interview. My guest is Adi Jaffe, PhD, world-renowned expert on mental health, addiction, relationships and shame. I'm going to go into your background in a moment, Adi, but I just want to say welcome and what a massive pleasure it is for me to get to chat to you, because I've heard you speak on various podcasts and various things over the years. In fact, when I was in my very early days of sobriety and kind of I've been sober three and a bit years, and I remember hearing you speak on a podcast when I was fairly early on. And we'll talk about that particular topic later, but you were just so important to keeping me inspired. So it's a real pleasure to chat to you.
Thank you so much, Jane. That really does mean the world.
Well, I'd love to know, before we get into all the current stuff you're doing and you're going to tell us about Ignited, before we get into all of that, just tell us a bit about your background, because you've been a lecturer for years. You've been involved in progressive mental health treatment facilities. So just give us a little bit of a potted history.
Sure. I have been doing all those things. But before that, I was a lost kid. Really, since a very early age, I'd say I knew I was lost and weird since about 8 or 9. And I kept trying to find ways to deal with that. Very socially anxious, very awkward. I only remember this in the last few years, but I used to go home with stomach pains that I realized now were almost like ulcers and deep GI issues from my high levels of anxiety in elementary school. So, grew up in that, and then found alcohol and then weed and then other drugs later to help fix that anxiety. And it did a pretty damn good job for long enough for me to feel like it was allowing me to handle it. I didn't realize that what it was doing also was making me completely not trust that I had the internal ability to feel better about myself, but that I would always need something to fix me. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell the short version, although obviously there's my TED Talk and all these other places in the book that people can read the longer version of this, but it ended with a SWAT team arrest at my house in Brentwood here locally in Los Angeles at the time. It was the nice Beverly Hills SWAT team they were willing to make the journey from Beverly Hills to Brentwood, which was very nice of them. And I was dealing drugs. I owned guns by that point. I had this little mini criminal enterprise, and that's where my life ended me. And it was all very, it looks insane when you look at the end point, and it all made complete sense to me in the gradual interim. And I think that is what I bring to the equation for a lot of the people I work with, is the recognition that no matter how insane it seems in the end, it all made sense as you were going through it.
So
for me, one of the ways that I found my way out was by going in and trying to understand what happened. I went back to school by necessity. I couldn't get a job because after that whole SWAT team arrest, I have 9 felonies on my record and I couldn't get hired at the mall, right? A clothing store wouldn't hire me because I was a con, an ex-con. And so I ended up having to go back to school by literally just by necessity and did well. For the first time in my life since elementary school, I was very committed to schooling. And so I did really, really well in it. Ended up getting my PhD from UCLA, studying psychology and behavioral neuroscience and genetics and statistics. And yes, then I ended up lecturing. I lectured at UCLA. I started writing about my own story and being public about what happened to me and not ashamed of it around 2008. So can't believe that's already 12 years, but 13 mm-hmm. years, but that's about when that started. And so for a while I had a big blog and that parlayed into running a treatment center. And now I have a podcast and wrote a best-selling book called The Abstinence Myth. So I've sort of made addiction my life really mm-hmm. since I was 16 years old, studying it on the ground first, then studying in school, and now hopefully being able to parlay that information and that experience into helping people.
Yeah. Before we go any further, I'm just really interested when you use that expression, you know, when you're kind of you were a lost kid, you know. And I just wonder, looking back, what might have helped you had it have been different? I mean, I suppose, you know, none of us get to choose the circumstances we grow up in. But I always find it fascinating, you know, this whole nature versus nurture. Are we, you know, are we just the product of what's happening around us with our parents? Or is there something going on anyway? And is anything that might have helped you, you know, whether that be in the school system or the right teacher?
Man, what a great question. So, yeah, I do know, in retrospect now, some things that probably would have helped. Did anybody know at the time? Probably not. I was very good at masking my anxiety. Nobody could understand, even that stomach ache I was talking about. Nobody could understand why. Mm. It took years for me to figure out that that's what it was at an early age. But I was a latchkey kid. I didn't really see my parents at all during the day. I would go to school, come home, feed my little baby sister, and then just kind of hang out. This is pre, you know, there were no iPhones and video games. So it was kind of like, you would hang out and play outside. So that's one thing. I had pretty secure attachment, but a very small amount of real parental attention growing up. Mm-hmm. Also, my family was a Holocaust survivor family. And so a lot of just built-in angst and anxiety and fear. Mm-hmm. And again, right? I mean, now I know a lot of these things. And so the epigenetics influence of something like the Holocaust, right? My grandmother lost her entire family. She had 2 siblings that remained, but her parents and 3 other siblings and all these other nieces and nephews, et cetera, were all gone. And there was a palpable fear. I didn't have any big T trauma in my life. My dad left us for about 3 days or 2 days or 4 days. The story's not exactly clear, but my family had been through that trauma. And so, you know, it's hard for me to know how many things would have impacted it. But yeah, sure. Here are some things that I know I wasn't trained on at all. And it took me years to expressing your feelings.
Yeah,
was something I didn't even understand was a thing, let alone understand how to do it. My emotional vocabulary was incredibly limited. My dad was never, ever around, so I had no male parental role model, which meant that later on, I kind of developed my own version of what the ideal guy was going to be like, and then I just tried to be more like that. Mm. We also moved when I was 14. My life was pretty good. I mean, you know, I was maybe a little rebellious as a young teenager, but we moved when I was 14, right at the beginning of high school. And that was a bad idea. Mm. We moved to a different country. I grew up in Israel. We moved to the States. I spoke English, but not well. So I became that weird foreign kid, which really destroyed my social. I mean, talk about it. I was socially uncomfortable before. Now I was very socially awkward. So there were a few of those, I'll call them missteps along the way. Mm. That I think would have would have changed the trajectory. But here's the thing. I've worked with hundreds, if not a couple of thousands of people by now. And there are a lot of people where those things were in place, or many of them at least, and they still turned out struggling with an addiction or other related disorders. So it's definitely not a panacea.
No, absolutely. I just always find it fascinating. I really do. You know, I find it fascinating reading, you know, looking at Gabor Mate's work and Vincent Folletti with the ACE study, you know, and the fact that trauma in childhood can be so many things and actually really quite subtle things, and yet has such a massive impact on addiction. Tell me a bit about, you know, what when you got yourself sorted, basically, what was the thing that you really, you know, when you're thinking about when you wrote your book, what was the kind of crux of the message that you really wanted to pass across to people?
Look, if I'm honest, that message changes with time.
Yeah.
As sure. I learn and I get better at what I'm doing and I see more people. I mean, one of the guiding principles of my work, I believe, is that what worked for me doesn't have to work for you.
Yeah.
This isn't a, you know, color by numbers, follow the steps that I did. I'm trying to develop something completely different. And that is people's belief in self and their understanding that there is a path for them. And then my only job is to try to help them find the path that works for them.
Yeah, totally.
That's very different to me than, for instance, like the traditional AA model, which is read the book. It worked for those people. Let me tell you what my sponsor did for me. It worked for me. Therefore, it'll work for you as well.
Yeah.
And I don't want to get too carried away about that conversation, but that's really what I try to do for the people that I work with, is try to help them understand in as clear a way, as simple a way, as easy a way. I don't think this has to be hard. And that's why I call the company Ignited. What gets them going? What gets them ignited? What gets them excited? I keep thinking to myself that my next book is going to be called Stop Trying to Get Sober, because I've ended up using that line so many times. And
what do you mean by that? Because there's so much more?
Yeah, getting sober is not the goal. And it's actually probably not even the path. To getting sober, if you want to get sober, weirdly, you know, it's, I use this analogy in my program with a lot of the people that I work with, and it comes from, I've used it on my podcast, but maybe it'll be helpful for your listeners as well. When I moved to California, I learned how to ride a motorcycle, and I did it because we were relatively broke and I didn't have money for a car and I needed to buy a car for myself. So a motorcycle was $850. I could afford that. Parking was free on campus, and you know, bikes are cool, and I never felt cool. So it felt like a good meeting place for all. My mom hated it. The last thing on earth she wanted was her son riding a motorcycle, but it also made financial sense. So I got the right to do it. And I took this riding class, and for the first 2 hours, you watch videos and you learn about motorcycles. Then for the next hour, they have you walking with your motorcycle and not doing anything with it, just very gradually walking, getting the weight of it. And then you ride it and they only let you ride straight. And then you have to get off the bike, turn it by hand. And eventually you're sitting on the bike and they set up these cones. You've probably seen them if you've ever seen, like, or if you ever took like a driver's ed class. And they set you up for the next place, which is you're going to ride straight. And then when you reach the cone, you're going to turn. And then they teach you this thing. They tell you, people think that riding a motorcycle and turning is like a bicycle where you turn the wheel, but motorcycles don't work that way. They're a lot heavier. You're going much, much faster. And so the way you turn on a motorcycle is you lean in the direction you want to go in. They say it's a little scary when you first go and do it to lean a 500, 800 pound machine when you're going 30, 35 miles an hour.
Yeah.
And so they tell you, people have a tendency to look down because there's the asphalt just going really, really fast beneath you. But your body's center of gravity, the weight, goes where you look. And so they say, well, people make a mistake and they look down, the body center of gravity goes too low, and sometimes they end up crashing the bike because they're leaning into where they're looking, which is the ground. They said, don't do that. What you have to do is actually look out at where you're trying to get. So the end of the turn. Now, that may sound easy, but when you're going 35 miles an hour on an 800-pound machine, you turn, there's ground going beneath you. And for you to look about 100 yards forward is really scary at first.
Yeah,
because it feels like you have to manage your current situation. But what they teach us is if you look at what's happening down under you, you will go down. If you look ahead, you'll go where you're going. I think too often in recovery, we're worried about what's going on right now and we keep trying to fix it.
Yeah.
And we leave no space for where are we trying to go and what does our life look like in the future?
Mm.
Here's the problem. Your attention goes where you focus it. So if you sit around all day worried about everything that's going wrong because of your drinking, you're thinking about everything that's wrong and you're thinking about your drinking. And more of your attention will be focused on what's wrong and your drinking. And it's very hard to pull yourself apart from that. And that's where, to me, the whole notion of, well, you know, just don't have a drink, just go to another meeting, just do this, just misses the point.
Yeah.
I drank and I used drugs for a reason. Help me solve those reasons and I want to drink and use less.
Yeah.
And so it kind of flips the current trajectory of treatment oftentimes, which is like, just fix the momentary issue and everything will get better. I don't think that's true.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I love that analogy. It's what I'm talking about all the time with people that I work with is just try and catch sight of what's beyond, you know, just imagine that better life rather than, you know, focusing on what you're at. That's a fabulous analogy. And I know that when I heard you speak, you know, I alluded to the fact that I'd heard you on a podcast and you were talking about the fact that, you know, when we go on diets and stuff, that those of us have been on diets and most of us have, for God's sake, we sometimes, you know, we slip up and, you know, we have a Jaffa cake or whatever the hell. And you know what? We kind of then get back into it. And you were saying that when it comes to sobriety, we are so mean to ourselves. So, words to that effect.
So we're cruel. And look, unfortunately, and I think it's well-intentioned, but unfortunately, the system is cruel to us.
Mm.
It is insane to me. Insane. I mean, the more I talk about it, the more insane it is, actually. That somebody could have 15 years, have a really bad day, hour, week, month, and be told that they have to go back to the beginning of the line.
Mm, exactly.
I mean, where on earth does that happen outside of recovery? Where? That is unheard of. I mean, if we treated people with depression or anxiety or financial literacy needs or math or cooking skills or any other area of life this way, people will be laughed out the room.
Mm.
But what we've done is we've made, and I'm putting this in air quotes for those listening, we've made addicts and alcoholics this specifically different group of people that doesn't get to operate like the rest of humanity.
Mm.
If you have a drink, you've gone right back to where things started. And people then use examples. They say, oh yeah, well, you know, Jimmy had 20 years and then he started drinking and it went back to being as bad as it was before. Well, that's great that you have these anecdotal evidence pieces, but we also have confirmation bias and you also have expectancy bias and you have something called the Pygmalion effect, which means that the way we expect other people to behave makes them more likely to behave that way. So when you tell somebody who struggles with addiction that they are an addict and if they drink again or smoke weed or take a pill, they'll go back to the way things were before. Whether you want to or not, you're making it more likely that that will happen. You're making it more likely that they will see that as the outcome. And then to say to them, oh, you took a pill, you smoked some weed, you had a drink, you got to relinquish your 12 years of recovery.
You're a failure, effectively.
It is, and walk back into the room as if after failure, what we need is more humility.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think it's asinine. I think it's completely backwards. Mm-hmm. And I think whether people recognize it or not, it is one of the leading reasons for the level of failure we get within treatment, because people would rather leave than deal with that consequence. And if you're making people leave, you are by definition decreasing their odds of success.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know that, you know, the role of the shame is something you talk about a lot. It was something that was surprising to me, actually, that when I first stopped drinking, I felt so much shame. I mean, bizarrely, I didn't feel any shame when I was drinking. But when I stopped, oh my goodness, the shame was just immense. So much so that I couldn't tell anyone. You know, I now know that that's not a good idea. But when I look back, and I've heard other people say, you know, very similar things, once you become, you know, aware, once your eyes are open, that terrible sense of shame at what's gone on, it leads to inertia sometimes, so that you find it really very hard to even you know, connect further. Tell us a bit more about some of the work you've done around shame and how you believe it affects people.
Yeah, so, you know, my insight into shame came not anecdotally. I actually didn't work on it at all until I did a postdoc study. So I'd already got my PhD. I was really interested in technology and its use in addiction. I was already, I was 3 years sober, and then I went out, quote unquote, and started drinking moderately. And it's been fine for the last 17 years. It hasn't been an issue for me. But I wanted to study how we can use technology to make addiction treatment better. And I was focused on a very simple piece of the puzzle, not on the treatment itself, but how do we help people find treatment? So I created this really beautiful, in my opinion, online website that asks people questions they know the answer to, like, what are you using? How long? What's your family structure like? How much money do you have? What insurance do you have? Things they actually can answer, not what kind of treatment you need. They don't know that. And then match them to treatment. And as we did that, we recruited participants for a research study. And the way I phrased the study was to see what made people get into treatment. Well, it was in lining up that study that I realized, oops, I'm asking the wrong question. Most people don't go get treatment. It blew my mind, and maybe it'll blow somebody's mind when I say this now, that 90% of people with addiction problems don't ever get professional help for it.
Yeah.
90%. It's like, it's mind-boggling. There's no other field where that happens. In depression, something like 60 to 70% of people get help. Diabetes, it's like 70 to 80. Cancer, it's 80 to 90. They get help. Like the opposite of what happens in addiction. And so what I became interested in seeing, well, why don't people get help? And so we found four factors. It was a 2-year study. It took a lot of work to get done, but obviously cost and logistics.
Yeah.
Those make sense. Treatment can be very expensive. I think it's sad that it's that expensive. It's what we're trying to fix with Ignited. But it is. It's pretty expensive. Average episode of treatment costs $10,000.
Is that for a rehabilitation center?
So this is across the board, but right, normally, okay. Yeah, it's the cost of residential or inpatient substantially increases the cost there.
Yeah.
Those can be upwards of 20, 30, 40,000 a month, but outpatient is more like 2 to 3,000. So it averages out to about 10. Then logistics, you know, everybody thinks you have to be serious to get help on your addiction, but I can be very serious about many things in my life and not have the ability to leave my family and my work for 30, 60, 90 days to go get residential help for it. Or even outpatient treatment. Intensive outpatient is 10 to 15 hours a week. That's a massive commitment.
Yeah.
I'm a pretty privileged person in the universe and I recognize that. But if you're working a job and a half, two jobs to support your family, that's a massive ask. Mm. So logistics were another big one. And then in the survey, shame came up as a massive problem, especially in the first 6 months of seeking, because we followed these people for about a year. And in the first few months when they were just starting to look for help, like you described, Janie, right? When they were starting to understand they needed to do something was when the shame was the biggest.
Yeah.
And so they weren't reaching out for help, not in terms of where to go for treatment, not in terms of talking to somebody in treatment because they felt so much shame. What they literally said was, I want to fix this on my own. I don't want to tell anybody about it. I'm ashamed of it. So they were looking for help, but just not talking about it because of the shame. Yeah. And then last but not least, abstinence. 50 to 60% of people told us that it was a pretty serious impediment to them getting help. They said, I know I need help, but I either enjoy using or drinking too much to quit, or I'm not ready to quit. And and people traditionally look at that audience as saying is not serious about getting help. But I call BS on that too. It's like, I can be serious about wanting help with depression, but not know if I can ever be not depressed again. I can, I can want help with my weight, but not know if I'm never going to have a donut. This commitment to, you must commit ahead of time to never drinking again, is a really high barrier.
Yeah.
And we've sort of put the onus on the people who need help to just come up with the resources for that, right? We say to them, well, if you're really serious about this, you'll commit to giving up forever the thing that has made your life livable to this moment. And we look down at people who aren't willing to do it. So when I learned that, especially the shame and the abstinence components, because everybody knew about cost and logistics, I said, you know, I can't just sit in my ivory tower and do research on this. I've got to go out and fix it and help people do this themselves.
Yeah.
And that's really what started my public writing and talking about ways to help the public understand that there's a completely different way of understanding addiction.
Mm, definitely. I know that one of the things you've worked in, I think you've got an online course, a workshop on, I think you call it something like SOS Family, where you're talking about family members. And well, I mean, this is not an area that I have any experience in at all, but I am occasionally asked by people, you know, if there's someone in my family who, you know, has an addiction, can I help them? Now, it's a difficult one, isn't it? You know, because, you know, if it's a partner, I've heard people say, I don't want to become the enabler for that person. Yeah. So that's difficult. Sure. But then by the same token, aren't we meant to be kind? We're not just going to chuck someone out, right? Or if it's a parent or, you know, goodness, this is a complex issue. But I'd love to know what your take on it.
Well, this might be a really good resource for people. So we actually have two things there. They're called the Family SOS. And we have a workshop that's just a 2-hour workshop that is pretty easy. And we have a full course. It's like a 2-month program for people who are serious about it. And we've even made it so easy that if somebody buys the workshop and then said, okay, I really love this, I want to do the full program, we will give them credit for the workshop in buying the program. Mm-hmm. But the reason for doing it is an important one. I have now talked to hundreds of family members, hundreds over the years, and they just don't know what to do. And the problem is, and I hate saying it this way because I'm part of this system, the problem is that the addiction treatment complex almost keeps it that way by definition. Why? Because if people aren't informed, you can give them whatever you have and they'll be thankful for it. You can charge them $60,000 for essentially a fancy hotel with AA meetings twice a day. And they won't know that they need to ask for more. Now, there are really good treatment centers that have very well-trained staff that do really good work and cost $20,000, $30,000, $50,000, $10,000 a month. And then there are really crappy treatment centers that almost don't give you anything but food, a place to rest your head, and transportation to meetings. The members of a family have no idea how to tell the difference between those two.
No.
And by staying opaque, the system benefits. Because if you don't know what to ask, you don't know if you're getting something good or bad, and then it's easy for them to fill in the gaps and tell you the story.
But I'm guessing that with many people in this position, the person who has the addiction doesn't even necessarily, you know, they don't even want to be fixed, as it were. So I suppose you're then talking about intervention of some kind.
So many things. I'm going to take notes because I want to make sure we get to it. Look, nobody wants to get fixed. We want to feel good and we want to feel better.
Sure, no, absolutely. Yeah.
And we want to be comfortable. So I would say most people that I've worked with, and again, this is not true across the board, but most people I work with recognize something's off.
Yeah, of course.
If I was speaking in my usual, more crude language.
Oh, feel free. We don't mind crude.
I say, they know shit's fucked up.
Yeah.
They get it. they just have no idea what to do about it. And the layers of shame and levels of disappointment and guilt and embarrassment they have make them hide. And so it's not that they don't know what's going on. But here's the thing. We know this from relationship work and couples counseling. You can't come to your partner and say, you really pissed me off when. The moment you do that, you're done. And so you're now not having a constructive conversation in the same way that you can't come to somebody who's using drugs and say, you got to stop doing this. They know that. Mm. You're not providing any additional resources. So what our programs do is walk people through motivational interviewing, craft methods, yes, interventions, but not what you think of. You know, when people think of an intervention, they think of a specific model that got made famous by the show and movies and things like that. It's called the Johnson Institute model of intervention. It's the one where everybody writes letters and you ambush them and you sit them in a circle and say, if you don't go to treatment right now, we're not going to talk to you and you got to get out of the house. Mm. It's not a very successful intervention model.
No, I'm not surprised.
It's very
conflict. Can't think of anything worse.
It's rich in conflict. It creates a lot of animosity. 60% of people who start out trying to plan one of these don't even go through with it. And it is true that if you do go through with it, like 50 or 60% of people will end up in treatment. But they don't go always because they want to go. No. They go to get you off their back.
Yeah, of course.
So a more appropriate or a more long-term version of an intervention model is this. You do need boundaries. Yeah. Being a what people are calling an enabler means helping make it easier for a person to make decisions that might be bad for them. Mm. You need boundaries. You need clear communication. You need a roadmap, right? You have to come to a person with, if you're going to come and offer solutions, make them part of the equation, excuse me, but also offer solutions. It's not, don't make it a black or white decision. Choice is a very important part in what we teach. And so our programs for the families teach them how to have some ownership over what happens. And of course, the best is when you get that started and then the person gets a little restless and uncomfortable, and they're willing to do some of their own work. And when both parties are doing the work, you get, I mean, magnificent changes. We have people in our Ignited Hero program who had family members who took the Family SOS program. And I mean, they report on this. It is like night and day in their life. It is as if, and I jokingly say this to people all the time, that anybody can beat addiction to anything. You just have to become a person who's not addicted. And they think I'm crazy when I say it. But once you do the work, I think it makes a lot of sense. So when you become a person who's not addicted and your family members become somebody who is not triggered by your old behavior to believe that you are still the quote unquote addict that you always were, you can get very healthy, beautiful, intimate, long-lasting relationships where 6 months, a year earlier, everybody thought the wheels were coming off and it was never going to be okay. Mm-hmm. And that to me is the power of the work, is when you see the transformation, it's worth everything.
Yeah, absolutely. Tell us about the, you know, Ignited then, smart, personalized, adaptive recovery system. Love it. Tell us all about what you offer.
Sure. So here was my concept a long time ago when I did that postdoc. Okay, people are not always ready to abstain. I know from my own history that I abstained for a while and then was moderate after and it worked okay. I know some people for whom that doesn't work. I know that therapy and things like CBT worked really, really well for me. I also changed my diet and my exercise a lot, my lifestyle changed. But then I see AA plus meditation work for other people, et cetera. Mm. And what I started thinking about is, okay, what if instead of finding the thing to help people, we created a system that found the specific way for you to get help? Now, there's a concept like that in addiction for 15 years. I saw a talk on it when I was a grad student. It's called adaptive treatment. Mm-hmm. The idea is this. Janie, you want to come in for some help? We give you the thing that we think would be best for you based on whatever we know about you. So let's say we believe that this course of treatment, version A, is the best for you. Mm. And then we see how you're doing in it. And if you're doing well, hallelujah and amen, we found a good solution, move forward. If you're not doing well, we have ways of measuring that and understanding it. and then we switch you to something else that might work better. Mm. Or we keep some of it and we switch elements of it to other pieces that might work. So we may try CBT with you at first, but that might be too cognitive and too thought-based and you want more emotional stuff. So then we go to DBT or we go to mindfulness or something along those lines, meditation. And we keep moving pieces around until we find the pieces that work for Janie. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally.
So it's called adaptive treatment. And it has been, there's been research on it for 15 years. Really, really hard to do. Because you can imagine going to a rehab and them not only trying to do the regular work with you, but then figure out if that work is doing you any good or not. Mm. And then be honest enough and not egocentric enough and well-trained enough to say, hey, Janie, what we tried didn't work really well. So we're going to keep one or two pieces, but we're going to change everything else you're doing. It takes a lot of effort, a lot of work, and potentially a lot of training and money. So nobody's ever been able to figure out how to make it actually work on the ground. Mm. What we're doing at Ignited is we're building what I believe is the first adaptive recovery system. And what I mean by that is an entire ecosystem of recovery where different specialists, different methods, different expertise is all available, but you don't have to get all of it. You get little pieces of it. And then we measure how it helps you. And if it's helping you, we keep going. And if any pieces of it seem like they're not working, we switch out those pieces. So I'm one of the coaches and I started the program, but now we have six other coaches. You may not like listening to me talk. You may like our coach Kate talking a lot better. An adaptive recovery system will give you less of me and more of Kate. Because I don't need you to like me. I just need you to be doing better. One of our coaches is really great at meditation and hypnosis and these kind of deep, you know, sort of a parasympathetic activation, deep dive, below consciousness sort of techniques. Some people hate that concept. They despise it. And other people are drawn to it like moths to a flame. Instead of making people do it, what we're doing is we're matching people who are better suited for it into that system. And so the Ignited Hero program sits on the understanding of F shame, first of all. There's nothing wrong with you as a human being. You're not a bad person. You've made the best choices you can make till now and you want to change them, and that's great.
Yeah.
You don't have to commit to anything other than doing the work and showing up. And then we try to espouse principles like radical transparency, where we get to be very transparent and honest with all of our people. And then it's our job to best match them to the approaches that work for them. And we've now run about 1,000 people, a little over 1,000 people through it. We bring about 35 to 47% reductions in people's use within about a month or two. Mm-hmm. People tell us they like our system better than whatever they were doing before by about 2.2 times. So 220% better than what they were doing before. They like it better. They engage in it and it's cheap. Mm-hmm. Like our programs go from $27 a month to about $250 a month, depending on how much you engage in. And I wanted to make this cheap and affordable because we know cost is one of the barriers. So my goal right now is to actually create this entire different recovery ecosystem where it's not about my method and it's not about AA and it's not about religion-based programs or cognitive behavioral therapy. Mm. It's about a platform, a system that helps each person who comes in figure out what works for them and then have an ongoing support network that supports their needs and not my belief in what they need.
Mm, I love that. It really is that holistic approach, isn't it? I absolutely love it. I really do relate to this because I'm a big believer that, you know, one size does not fit all. You know, I've had four kids and it was not that, you know, they couldn't all cope in the same school, or we did homeschooling. We've tried a bunch of everything and they're not all the same, you know, and it's utterly ridiculous to try and, you know, think that we all fit in one box. Sounds amazing what you're doing. So just tell us where we can find more information. Just give us the website.
Yeah, absolutely. So the overall system I laid out in the book, The Abstinence Myth, I have a copy right here. obviously the book rests on the idea that you don't have to commit to quitting. And actually one level beyond it, it even goes into the concept that you shouldn't measure your recovery by quitting. So you should stop measuring how you're doing simply by whether you're drinking or not. You can be still drinking, but less and less frequently and be doing great in your recovery, or you can be completely abstinent and be having a terrible recovery. Both are possible. And so that's one piece. And the rest of the principles are in the book. And you'll learn about the Ignited Recovery Program in there. But then you can go to ignited.com, and that's IGNTD.com. Or if you want to go all in, to Ignited Recovery, IGNTDRecovery.com, and you'll learn about it. But the overall message that I want everybody to get is, look, I love my system. I think it does people really, really well. But just like what we try to do for people, or what we do for people in our recovery platform called Sparks, every person listening right now, if you're still struggling to get where you're trying to go, I want to be really clear. There's a set of tools out there that put together is the perfect puzzle for what you need. We call this the first level in our Ignited Hero program. We call them seekers. Your job is just to look for the tools that work for you and to find the hope and the belief that there is another place. As you mentioned, Janie, when you first start, things are going to be tough. They are going to be tough because whatever you were drinking for will come front and center if you stop drinking. And so I encourage people to experiment with things like abstinence sampling. Try a few hours of not drinking. Try a day. Try 3 days of not drinking. You don't have to commit to lifelong abstinence to get started. Play with your drinking. Challenge yourself in different ways. And then use those lessons to find the tools that will help you address, like in my instance, the social anxiety or, you know, early life intimacy sort of void and gap that I had. And for each one of us, if you can find a system that supports your own inquiry into what will make you better over time, guaranteed things will improve.
Absolutely. Oh, it's fantastic to chat to you. I could talk to you forever. I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, I love this.
It's great. It's great to chat to you. I love the work that you're doing. And thank you so much for taking the time to chat to us on the Alcohol Free Life podcast. I really appreciate it, Adi.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you, Dr. Adi. Just to mention, our Champneys events are hopefully happening the end of May. I think that one's booked up. I think there's one in June. Make sure you check that out. 26th of June, I think it is. Possibly July and September. So there's a bunch of spaces. They're very small, but there is availability. If you look at thesoberclub.com and click on events, you'll see the link there. Probably best to phone them up and see if you can get a space. It would be absolutely wonderful to see you on our self-care and sobriety retreats. It's perfectly cool if you haven't stopped drinking or if you've been sober for 10 years, 15 years, doesn't matter. It's all about self-care and how to live your best life. So we'd love to see you at that. I wanted to mention that there's a competition in on the UK Mums website. UKMums.tv have done a competition to win my book, Happy, Healthy, Sober, and also a year's membership to the Sober Club. So that is a meaty old prize there. So if that's something you'd be interested in, have a check of their website. And also on my website, on imperfectlynatural.com, I've got a bunch of competitions as well as the soberclub.com, just to be a little bit confusing. But it's worth checking it out because on imperfectlynatural.com, in addition to the many alcohol-free drinks that we have to offer in our competitions, you can also win some organic wheatgrass juice. Now, you've heard me bang on about juicing, and of course, in my book, I write a lot about fresh juices. And there's a fantastic company called Brits Superfoods, and they're offering us a competition to win some organic wheatgrass juice. So this arrives frozen, so you don't have to do all the work. You basically just take it out of the freezer and pop it into your smoothie or whatever you want to do with it. So check those out. It's absolutely worth entering. Got to be in it to win it and all that stuff. Once again, make sure that you follow me on social media at Janie Lee Grace. Make sure you stay connected. If you are struggling, whatever's going on for you, just reach out, get some support, get some help. Obviously, I'd love it if you check out the Sober Club. It really is just such an amazing place for support and accountability and inspiration and great content. So many videos in there. A lot of people have been struggling with the great sugar monster this week, and we've got some fantastic content in there around ditching sugar, alternatives to sugar, how to reduce cravings, all of that stuff. So there's a massive kind of library of content there. And the Sober Club is small. You know, this is not a big thing. It's really quite small. So if it's something that resonates, do have a look. If, by the way, and this is on a completely different note, but if you're someone who has a business or you're thinking of starting a business and you're interested in running your own membership site or rocking your kind of business online, then I've hooked up with Stu McLaren, who has an event called Tribe every year, and he really is the king of membership sites. And I worked with him, did some training with him. His stuff is just fantastic. He's so passionate and enthusiastic about the power of connection and the power of community. And certainly for me, it's been one of the best things I've ever done, being able to run the Sober Club, because the differences that you get to see in other people, you know, and ourselves is amazing. So just as a complete aside, if anyone's listening to this who has a business and has been thinking to themselves, wow, I'd love to start a community or have a subscription service or a membership site, then drop me a message and I'll send you a little bit more information about a completely free workshop. So drop me a DM or you know, find me on social media or go to the show notes, and there's loads of ways of contacting me there, and I'll give you some more information. I look forward to seeing you same time next week for the podcast. I've got some great guests coming up in the next few weeks, and as always, if you've got any suggestions for guests, let me know. Stay super proud of yourself if you're doing this hard thing, and give yourself a massive pat on the back. See you soon. Thank you for listening to the Alcohol Free Life podcast, brought to you by The Sober Club. Please rate and review. And if you want support, accountability and inspiration, and you want to live your best life without the booze, check out thesoberclub.com.